Right on time. Let's we're going to move to the fourth feast, which is Esther's feast. And we might make this comment. We'll try to go through feasts four and five and the intervening periods. And they're probably I like the way chapter 2, verse 18 says it, the great feast, even Esther's feast. There is a fair amount of, I'll just call it a preamble to that feast. The feast doesn't begin until verse 18, chapter 2, but almost from early part of it, we have what I have titled the selection of Esther, her selection to be queen. These events will eventually were to lead her to her selection. They're probably kind of, I'd like to kind of read them. Maybe I'll give you the group, and we'll look at it in the scriptures. There, with Vashti's refusal to come, there is a search to be made for the bride, the bride for the king. And I think our mind should drift back to what the parable we read in Matthew 22 by Jesus. You know, that says they were sent out into the highways. Of course, it's speaking of a subsequent period, but here with Esther, we have the search begins, and Mordecai brings forth Esther. And, you know, that if we just took that little statement, and you know, to me, it's a very powerful statement. Mordecai, Christ, brings forth Esther, bride. So, who brings us forth? You know, you and I become the antitypical bride. So we are brought forth by Yeshua the Messiah. In other words, without him, there would be no salvation. But that kind of shows you the way Yahweh writes his word to us. Sometimes we can pick up three little words in the middle of a fairly profound dissertation, and yet those words are very powerful. So Mordecai brings forth Esther. We're told of her, she had neither father nor mother. She was taken out of Jerusalem and carried to Babylon. Her name was changed. Remember, her name was Hadassah, meaning myrtle. And, you know, there's significance in it. I think the myrtle is an evergreen. And it makes me think of what Jesus said to his father, you know, that what he had done for him before the foundation of the world. And you might, let's pick that thought up. It's in Ephesians chapter 1. This is, I think, to me, it tells us the depth of things that we don't understand. From Ephesians 1, let's read 4 and 5. I should read 3 for the thought. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus anointed, who hath blessed us with all spiritual blessings in heavenly places in the anointed. A powerful setting. Then it says, according as he, that is Yahweh, hath chosen us in him, probably Yeshua, before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before him in love, having predestinated or foreshadowed or foreknown us into the adoption of children by Yeshua anointed to himself, according to the good pleasure of his will. So, you know, that's when those things are said of Yeshua, said to of all true believers. And I don't think it takes us any jump in our understanding to understand that if we are true, and we will be of that multitude of men and women who someday inherit the kingdom, we were known and selected. before the foundation of the world. Now, it's a thought that's probably almost, well, not almost, it is beyond our capacity to fully comprehend.
Okay. So she was taken out of Jerusalem, carried to Babylon, her name was changed, adopted by Mordecai, placed in the care of, now I can't necessarily pronounce this, but Haggai, H-E-G-A-I. And I have noted for that Psalm 34:7, the angel of the Lord encampeth round about him that fear him and delivereth them. And Hebrews 1:14, which says, are they not, speaking of angels, it says, are not they ministering spirits sent forth to minister to those who are heirs of salvation? So, you know, notice here, just for your, you know, consideration, this is within that selection process, these things occur. A great verse for us to keep in mind is, it says in verse 11, 2:11, and Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Now, isn't that a great point for us to comprehend? So Yeshua does for us, should make us very mindful of how much we are cared for, what has brought us to this place, and what has caused us to be attained to such a high calling. But we remember what is said there, we can apply to what Yeshua does for his followers. This process types in great detail the selection process of all spiritual Israelites. So therefore it speaks of our calling. So if we're true Israelites, you know, I think we will be mindful of it, and it'll have a lot of effect upon us. Verse 9 includes the fact that the body of Christ is represented by Esther having a company of 7 maidens that are not named to accompany her. We see this group both collectively and individually before the king. Keep in mind that all this is before the actual feast occurs. She now has 12 months of preparation, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet odors and other things. Only thing I can do with that, those 2 6 months, obviously it's a year, and some of you may have some good thoughts. And I personally believe that the depth to which we can search, particularly Esther's feast, the banquet of wine, are almost limitless. I want to read something from Brother Thomas on that point. But anyway, with that, at 360 days, which is the product of 40, number of probation, times 9, judgment. So I think that probably speaks of a process to which one goes through when they're in this final process. It says about Esther that she obtained favor in the sight of all and required nothing. That's a challenge to us, I think. The procedure was to go from the house of the women, king's house, in the evening, and in the morrow return to the custody of Shehazgaz, in another house of the women, to return no more unless called by name. Okay, verse 16, which is pivotal to this subject, it says, so Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus in his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So we want to note a couple of things. By the way, that's the same period that's spoken of in Ezra 7:6, if you'd like to. Brother Scott made mention of this yesterday. I was supposed to have Esther ahead of him having Esther 7, so he would be following. But we had I hope that's been made clear that, see, we originally started these with chronologically. We were going to do the first 6 of Ezra, Ryan did. The Esther would be inserted, and then Scott would pick up in Nehemiah, which is the way it really occurred. Jimmy had to go back to work, so I traded with him, and that moves me to Thursday. But it got us out of, I think as long as we all follow that we're not exactly in chronological being, that's one reason I want to go back and read this verse, because this would be the exact same year when it says Esther went up to the royal throne, the royal house, in the 7th year of his reign. Read 7:6 of Ezra, which Scott read for us yesterday, and it says, there went up some of the children of Israel and of the priests and Levites and singers and porters and the Nethinims unto Jerusalem in the 7th year of Artaxerxes, or 7th year of the king, says in 8. So that is the same year that we're talking about of in Esther being taken up into the king's house. So the same year that Ezra came forward, Esther is taken up into the house royal. It's a great picture. But we just note that this is 4 years after the Feast of Ahasuerus that we looked at in chapter 1 a few minutes ago. Okay, the 4 years is clearly significant. I guess the first thing that I would suggest we make sure we appreciate is it's the number of Israel, it's also the number of the city, 4-square city of the apocalypse from Revelation 21, already alluded to. But, you know, just keep it in mind that, you know, this was just not an insignificant occurrence. This moment, the king put a crown on the head of Esther, for she had obtained grace and favor. Let's read a couple of verses on that. Let's look at 2 Timothy 4, 7, and 8. Paul speaking at the concluding time of his life, he says, I have fought a good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which Adonai, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day, not to me only, but unto all them that love his appearing. Also look at Revelation 19, 7 through 9. Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb hath come, and his wife hath made herself ready. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of saints. The marriage feast is partially described in John 2, the marriage at Cana of Galilee. John 2 probably is suggesting the reason for the crowning of Esther, as well as the reasoning of Vashti. The law was the expression, they have no wine. Jesus provided the wine to enable the feast at the marriage in Cana to come to pass. That was the first sign of John, and we've already read from it. This future time of rejoicing, seen in verse 18, we're back in Esther. Let's read verse 18. The king made a great feast unto all the princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. I think we see there very easily Revelation 19. This time will bring release to the provinces, says the antitypical year of Jubilee. That's from Leviticus 25, 9 through 13. I think we won't read that, but you might just note it. We'd be familiar with the release in the year of Jubilee. Verse 19, virgins gather together. And note it says, second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. You know, just one comment. I think, you know, the second time to me tells us to not only the first coming, some of this would be applicable, but also the second coming. We see Mordecai sitting in the gate, and there's going to be some further references to that time. But if we think of, in a real sense, today, Jesus sits in the gate. There will be a time in the future when he continues to be there, which is in a subservient position to his Father. And then we will find him leaving the presence of the royal throne. And it'll all be depicted in these feast periods. So we see Mordecai sitting in the gate. Let's look at the banquet of wine. We first see the phraseology in, let's read 5:2. I guess let's go ahead and read 5:1-2. It came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel, stood in the inner court of the king's house, over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house, over against the gate of the house. And it was so that when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. The king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said unto her, "What wilt thou, Queen Esther? What is thy request? It shall be even given thee to the half of the kingdom." And Esther answered, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day into the banquet that I have prepared for him." Stop there for a second. By the way, and I don't want to miss this in case I don't have it all. We're going to look at them individually if we have a moment. But in that place is one of the hidden names of Yahweh. I think it's in the paper you have that the hidden name of Yahweh appears four times in the banquet of wine. Three times as Yahweh, and one time as Air, I will be. You might just note those. It's on the second page of the handout. Yahweh appears four times in the banquet of wine. Chapter 5, verse 4. Chapter 7, verse 5-7. Chapter 5, verse 13. Three times as Yahweh, and one time as Air, or I will be. I'd suggest, I want to get into that a little bit if we have a chance, but we don't, make a mental note. Mr. Bullinger in Appendix 60 in the Canyon Bible has a great presentation of that. But from his text of the Jewish Bible, I think he sometimes says it's used four times. Gets into the appendix on page 60, he says it's used five times. So obviously, either number is a good number, but might take a look at it. Okay, the banquet of wine was approximately 5 years after Esther's feast. So if we go back to the time, and you pick that up on your chronology, banquet of wine would be not on there. You'd have to follow it from the Bible, but it is approximately 5 years after Esther's feast. Therefore, 9 years after the feast of chapter 1, Ahasuerus. It comprises banquet of wine. That is comprises chapters 5, 6, 7, and part of 8. So a major part of Esther is connected to the banquet of wine. And that has to kind of hit our eyes, I think. This feast, which is number 5, would last 2 days with the intervening night. To talk about it, let's look at Hosea 6:1-2. I think this is a time span from the Jewish viewpoint. I should say related to Jewish times. Hosea says, "Come and let us return unto Yahweh, for he hath torn and he will heal us. He hath smitten and he will bind us up. After 2 days will he revive us. In the third day he will raise us up and we shall live in his sight." I think that's the time it's spoken of. Now, obviously, when we take that to the Gentile side, it would be, those 2 days would be days 5 and 6. Here they would also be 5 and 6, but we're looking at it from a Jewish vantage point. Chapter 8:1, and I want to flip over that just to read where we're headed. Chapter 8, verse 1 says, "And that day did King Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, to Esther the queen. Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told him what he was, had told what he was to her." So 8:1 mentions an unidentified day, only as on that day. Our suggestion is this. It is the seventh day or the third day of Luke 13:32, when Jesus says, a message to Herod, "The third day I shall be perfected." Let's take a look at that. Turn that up, please. Luke 13:32. Just to get the context, let's read 31:2, because it tells us who's bringing up the trouble. "The same day there came certain of the Pharisees, saying unto him, Get thee out and depart thence, for Herod will kill thee. And he said unto them, Go ye and tell that fox, Behold, I cast out devils, and I do cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected." So if you can transport that back to 8:1, I think that "and that day" spoken of is that day, the day of the perfection of the body. Note that's, we have to look at what's said in the earlier part of the banquet of wine. First, this day must be viewed from two aspects. This is kind of important for us, I think. Firstly, the day of the crucifixion of Jesus. That means the day in which the ratification of the covenants of promise, one, and two, that day in Teman, when the saints begin their march from march to Zion, as recorded in Habakkuk 3, Deuteronomy 33, Isaiah 63, and Apocalypse 10. So when we think about this day, think of each of those days. Day of crucifixion, and perhaps, well, I should say, closely to 2,000 years later. So, you know, there is a overture in this banquet of wine to not only First Advent, the events of the First Advent, but also the Second Coming and the events of the Second Advent. Okay, while 6:1 says on that night, let's take a look at 6:1. It says, "On that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king." On that night tells us of the night that precedes the dawn of the seventh day. See John 9:4. Take a look at John 9:4. Jesus says, "I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work." So Jesus, I think, is saying that when the night comes, he will be gone, and the darkness will cover the earth. So he speaks of he tells his disciples of the coming night when no man can work. This night of Esther 6:1, Haman is planning the destruction of the Jewish people and Mordecai. So we immediately see the reference into the day of crucifixion. And I think maybe that may be primary, but I think this reference is both the crucifixion and the night before the dawn. And we find that in 2 Peter 1:19. Let's turn that up, please. 2 Peter 1:19. "We have also a more sure word of prophecy, whereunto you do well that you take heed, as into a light that shineth in a dark place, until the day dawn and the day star arise in your heart, your hearts. You know, when we think about 6:1 talking about the king could not sleep, you know, we think of the psalm that says, you know, he slumbereth not nor sleeps. We have to realize this is very symbolical, but what's going on is, as he is having a restless night, he reads the book of the Chronicles and considering what has been done to him and who had, or what was planned against him and who had helped him or had caused him the conspiracy of Bigtham and Teresh to be averted. Let's go ahead and read verse 2 of 6. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains and keepers of the door, who sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. The king said, "What honor and dignity have been done to Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants that ministered unto him said, "There is nothing done for him." Well, then the king looks out to the court, and he says, "You know, who's out there?" And they say, "That's Haman." Haman was outside. The story goes on. He's brought in, but the plan has been, the king now knows that Mordecai is the one who had helped him, or had, on behalf of him, had averted the tragedy of an assassination. Plan went according to schedule by the work of Mordecai, the Lord Yeshua the Messiah. As to the night, the time is depicted in the hymn we sing of the night, when Jews and Gentiles joined together against the Son of God to fight the conspiracy of Bigthan and Terah, who kept the gate, speaks of the time of that time. When you think of them keeping the door, think of the way that they kept it. And of course, clearly they're typical of the scribes and Pharisees. And what did Jesus say to them? Now, I didn't look up the verse. I just wrote down my recollection that they don't go in. They prevent those who want to go in from going in. That's the way they kept the door. As in Yahweh's plan, Haman was elevated to the highest point in his life. We can imagine him, you know, on this occasion when it takes us really back to chapter 3, when he was getting all the attention and everybody was bowing to him. But who do we know did not bow? 3:2 says that Mordecai bowed not, nor did he give him reverence. Hence, Haman is a type of sin in the flesh. He was granted power for a time, in fact, for this period of the night. He was in control, for the king had given him his ring. That's in chapter 3, verse 10. But the authority would only bring death. Third day of chapter 5, 1, we find Esther putting on her royal apparel, standing in the inner court, facing the king who was sitting upon the royal throne and in the royal house. She obtained favor with the king. The king held out the golden scepter that was in his hand. Esther drew near, touched the top of the scepter, confirming that she understood now that she had obtained the favor of the king. That's all said, I think, in verse 4. I'm sorry, verse 1 of chapter 4. She drew nigh. Let's look at Ephesians 2:13. This is kind of something we thought was appropriate to touch upon a little bit. Ephesians 3, could be 2. It is 2. I'm sorry, I read it wrong. It's 2:13. We might read 12 and 13. That at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in the anointed Savior, we who were sometimes afar off are made nigh by the blood of Christ. So So when we see Esther drawing nigh, our suggestion would be she understands and has been made nigh. She has viewed the surroundings. She knows her situation. And she goes through that putting on royal apparel. We would say that's equivalent to putting on garments of salvation. Again, she has not reached the zenith of where she will come. She still is going to make a request for her and her people. And her request was, it was straightforward. Let the king and Haman come this day to the banquet. We're still in the banquet of wine. More revealing is a phrase in Hebrew. My Hebrew is not too good. Yebo Hamalek Wehanan Hayon. But what's important is it's YHVH. So it's the name of Yahweh in 5:4. We know that Yahweh was present, though not seen. He was the originator of the plan to unfold this day. This can help us to understand that the inclusion of the third day, the day of the crucifixion, and the day of the resurrection can both be identified with the first advent or first coming, and also with the seventh day, the day of resurrection. So day three and seven, and the intervening night are shown the feast of the banquet of wine. Hence, Haman is in his glory, because he sees this as the moment of his destruction of Mordecai and all the Jews. Look at verse 9 of chapter 5. Then went Haman forth that day, joyful and with a glad heart. So he planned the crucifixion. We obviously know that natural story, it's the hanging, but it speaks of the crucifixion of Yeshua. And he was looking at the hanging of Mordecai. In fact, he was building the gallows. We can contemplate, I think we've had a good feeling for that this week as we've gone through these lessons on the time of the return to Zion. We can contemplate the joy of the Jews, the wicked ones, scribes and Pharisees, when they thought Yeshua had been removed from their presence. The one who refused to bow down to Haman, but condemned them for the wickedness they had slain the Prince of Life. Let's look how Peter viewed that in Acts. Let's read 3:15. I guess we'll read 14 and 15. This is Peter talking and to the Jews, I think depicted his multitude of Israel. But ye denied the Holy One and the Just, and desired a murderer to be granted unto you. And you killed the Prince of Life, whom God hath raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses. You might also look at 2:26. Therefore did my heart rejoice, and my tongue was glad. Moreover also my flesh shall rest in hope. Read wrong, verse 36. Therefore let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God hath made that same Jesus, whom ye crucified, both Lord and Christ. The restless night would reveal the one to be honored was Mordecai. For his opposing the plan against the king, we see Mordecai in his work looking after Esther, the ecclesia, today, guiding her to become the wife of the king, his refusal to bow down to Haman, now ready to deal death, the death knell to Haman. Two aspects are to be seen. The removal of Haman, firstly, on the third day, sin in the flesh would be destroyed by Mordecai, type of the anointed Savior. Secondly, we are pointed forward to the seventh day, or the eighth day, if you prefer, when sin in the flesh will be destroyed in its final form, both individually and collectively, in both political religious aspects. Now, to understand the impact of that, I guess that day would be hearing the message of Zechariah the prophet, or Haggai the prophet. So, got a couple of minutes. Let's look those up. Well, I guess it's too much to read. You might just note politically that as to Gog, it's in Ezekiel 39. Let's hold and see if it's let's just read verse 4:39. You can glance your eyes through the rest of it. It says, "Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel." This is spoken to Gog of the land of Magog, along with Meshach and Tubal. "Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort, and to the beasts of the field to be devoured." And you know, you might note that the ravenous birds there is the multitudinous one, the rainbowed angel, depicted as ravenous birds, which ties itself in somewhat to Revelation 19. Revelation 17 through 19 give a more lengthy description of the papal destruction. Let's go to Revelation 17, 19. Because of time, we won't read extensively, but you can take a look at the events. Guess what I like best is the end of 18. Remember, this really includes three chapters, 17, 18, 19. Let's read 20. Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. The mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, "Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all." And then it tells us why. Because in her, in this verse 24, "in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all them that were slain upon the earth." And let's look at 1 Corinthians 15. This deals with the ultimate, and it's no doubt it has moved us to day 8. So when we talk about the banquet of wine, we need to be conscious that it includes the 8th day. This doesn't say it as clearly as you like. Read Eureka 5. 15, let's read 24 through 28. "Then cometh the end, when he shall have delivered," that's Jesus multitudinously, "have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, whom when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power, and he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed, death. For he hath put all things under his feet, but when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifested that he is accepted which did put all things under him. When all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all and in all." And you can cross-reference that into Revelation 21, 1 through 9. The appointed time, well, let's stop there. I've used up the time, so take a 10-minute break.